Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peek, and welcome to episode 31 of the Her Podcast. It's all about women, where we share the naked truth about her mind, her body, and her life. Oh boy, today we're talking about food addiction. Put that cupcake down. I saw you. Before we start right on in, I just need to let you know that this episode of Her is made possible by our friends at Smarty Pants Women's Complete Vitamins. They're delicious once-a-day gummies that contain the complete vitamin, mineral, folate, and omega mix, customized just for women. Trust me, you won't forget to take them because they taste so great. To learn more, please go to SmartyPantsVitamins.com. And just a quick reminder to hop on over to iTunes after our episode to rate this podcast and review us. We read those things and we love to hear from you. So come on down. All right. It's time for Her.
Her. The podcast.
The naked truth about women.
Her mind.
Her body.
Her life. It's all about Her.
And we're going to be talking about food addiction. And the expert is Molly Carmel, a dear friend and colleague. So Molly is a licensed certified social worker and is among one of the leading behaviorists in the field of obesity. She specializes in the treatment of weight management, eating disorders, and addictions. She's made it her life's mission to help people find a sustainable solution to the battle of obesity and related eating disorders. After battling an eating disorder for over 20 years and finding no solution in available treatment, she began her professional path towards creating The Beacon. Molly has a personal dedication to helping you create change and find solutions that work best for you. And this is all done at her beautiful place in New York City. Ah, the Beacon Program. Molly, welcome to the Her Podcast.
So great to be here, Pam. Thanks for having me.
Oh, boy. All right. So, this whole issue of food addiction. Now, obviously, you know I've written The Hunger Fix, which is one of the main consumer books on the relationship between addictive eating, right? And what kind of products out there really cause this, and what else is involved with the whole issue of food addiction, and what are some of the solutions? I really admire your work because you know, you've taken this to heart, and you deal with people who have this drive, this addictive eating. So tell us, what is your approach, and first backing up, what is this food addiction that you see so often in your practice?
So, yeah, Pam, I mean, first of all, I think that we are these little pioneers doing this, and it's so exciting that we're helping people to find these solutions. And I think with the food addiction piece, I don't know how it happened for you, but for me, you know, I was working in different realms of trying to help people to find sustainable solutions with their food and weight, and I kept on coming up against this piece. And when I started to really do the research and get into it, what people were eating was preventing them from doing any of the other things that you and I know help people to create sustainable change. And, you know, like any progressive illness, especially the processed sugar and processed carbohydrates, which is usually where we start over here at Beacon, is where people were really not being able to find success, because when those substances are in people's bodies and when the dopamine is going out of control, even the most brave attempts at trying to get a sustainable change going is almost impossible with the brain being lit up like that. And so we found that when we started to remove those foods and mostly teach people how to remove those foods, we started to see change. And the thing I really want to say is this process with food is done so imperfectly. And I find that we deal with people who are so black and white in their thinking. And so we find that people come in and then they make a mistake, and it's like if they had a car, they would go and slice all, if they had a flat tire, they would go slice all four tires. And how people behave with the food, even with addiction and food addiction, is not a sustainable way to maintain any change.
Oh, there's no question about it. And we now, I mean, I think you and I, when you mentioned that we're sort of pioneers in this effort, I think we are. I think that what we've done to, you know, in our own realms of work is taken the best of the remarkable science that's come out of the National Institute of Drug Abuse.
Yeah.
And put it to work. And note that the reward center can be in the brain, can be hijacked by all kinds of processes and substances. Interestingly, food addiction is both.
Yeah.
And so you don't have to be a heroin addict to understand this, that there's a cross-pollination across addictive processes and habits.
Yeah.
And that there are certain products. I can't even grace them with the word food, half of them. But
right.
I mean, I can't. There are science fair projects, right? I'm not talking about apples here, women out there in her podcast land. I'm talking about mostly refined and processed sugars, fats, and salts all put together or singly, but it's the hyperpalatables. And, you know, Molly, I know that you see people coming in who've just had a boatload of this. You know, on board,
yeah.
And they've been dragging it around, right?
And I think, yes. Oh, my goodness. And I think that, you know, I think I also see people that have this kind of delusional belief that they can moderate it. And they don't understand the brain science of moderation in any way. And I think there's such a fine line between the idea in recovery from food addiction that, you know, mistakes happen and then we get back on track, versus like a cheat day or, you know, everything in moderation or it's Christmas. And that having that moderation-based view of things exacerbates the addiction and the idea that sometimes we mess up and get back on track. Those are really, they look exactly the same to some people, but the idea is very, very different.
Well, I think it's also gotten a lot muddier, you know, for some people when they say that, indeed, you know, when it comes to heroin or cocaine or meth or someone who is clearly an alcoholic, right? You said there's no such thing as moderation. Well, it's sort of ludicrous to, you know, moderately do heroin, you know,
right.
And back and forth. And for an alcoholic, it truly, you know, is the same kind of thing. But then people say, oh, it's just food.
I know.
It's not like it's heroin. You know, there's that word just.
Mm-hmm.
Without realizing, again, you're not talking about an apple here. You
right.
know, I don't know anybody who's ever like, you know, as it were, become an apple head. You know, they sneak eat apples because the apples are at a level of sweetness and deliciousness that doesn't ignite the reward center. It certainly activates it, but it doesn't cause it to ignite through the ceiling. And then again, there are people who are more vulnerable to addictive type processes and habits. How about those people, the kinds of people you see in your practice?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, I mean, the other thing I think that we're really, that we need to put big, shiny glitter on, Pam, is that when people give up these substances, their lives get so much better. And it's so hard to see that while you're using the substance. You know what I mean? Don't you treat people like that, where they're like, oh my God, deprivation, I'm going to be so deprived, how am I ever going to live without it? And then you see them 3-6 months later, and their whole lives have changed. And like we say at Beacon, like, it's not about deprivation, it's about liberation. That these foods are really, what you're saying, keeping them, they're like hijacked. They're like completely in a terrorist community with their food.
Well, you know what I do? I love the fact that you brought up that whole D word, deprivation,
yes.
Because, you know, no one's ever deprived of heroin or methamphetamine. But when you're looking at, you know, processed sugar and certain fatty foods, et cetera, et cetera, you know, people say, oh, come on, you know, get over it. It's just that. We'll just have a small amount. Well, you know, the truth of the matter is there are certain products that just plain don't work for you. And here's the way I do it, and I know you do the same thing. I tell all of my own people to ask themselves two questions, you know, before they consume anything sitting in front of them, whether it's a beverage or some kind of a food product, right? The first question is, if I consume this, will I feel loss of control?
That's a beautiful way to put it.
Second question. Oh, yeah. Well, I feel loss of control. I mean, you know, really, seriously, an apple sitting there, you're like, oh, yeah, I'm going to go off the deep end with an apple. No, obviously, that's ludicrous. But it may, you know, maybe something else, right? So the second question is, if I consume this, whatever's sitting in front of me, will I feel shame, blame, and guilt? And so normally, these two go hand in hand. I use this as a guideline for my people. And I know you do too, because once they realize that both of these things are taking place, that you're feeling loss of control, you're going down the slippery slope of shame, blame, and guilt, then, honey, the only thing that's going to happen after that is a binge.
That's right.
All right.
That's right.
I mean, you know, what are you going to do? It's going to be a binge. Let's call it what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And the beautiful work done by Ashley Gearhart and others, these are scientists who've done brain scans with binge eating disorder people, et cetera, you know, clearly shows that there's 100% overlap in those, you know, in those brain scans in the reward center, showing precisely what happens during an addictive food process, that people who have addictive eating and binging, it's exactly the same thing.
Yes.
I mean, what else are you doing?
And
you can't be binging
forget.
On lettuce.
Yeah, I think people forget, or they're not aware of, I mean, when people get, I think the other thing is, like, when people are so stuck on not giving something up, that may be a really good reason to look at why you need to give it up. And what I see here, when I see the amazing success stories that I see at Beacon, which is just like the great gift of my life to get to work with people and help them find these solutions, I mean, I have people who wouldn't even consider going back to pecan pie and chocolate chip cookies because their life has gotten so much better. They are so rid of such extreme levels of shame, blame, and guilt. They are so done with their diet wars. I mean, they've really solved a long-term problem. And while, like, I mean, tell me something, Pam. Like, if moderation worked, like, count me in. Like, I would do it myself, you know, being someone in recovery for an eating disorder. Count me in. It just seems to cause more problems. Like, people go these great lengths to try to be moderate with their food. And the other thing I hear people say is, like, you know, but you have to eat. It's too hard to manage a food addiction because you have to eat. I'm like, nobody has to eat cupcakes. Like, truth be told, nobody has to eat cupcakes. And managing a food addiction is not as hard as people give it credit for, because the outcome and the gifts of it seem to be really incredible. Body, mind, soul, spirit, across the board, you know, cash and prizes, like big lotto excitement when people really, because I don't know about you, but here I see people who have struggled with this for years and years and years and years and years and years and years. And as I like to say, you know, struggling with something for that long will do something to your personality. It'll do something to your outlook on life. And solving it in the way that the science really supports, and solving it with people that support you and all the stuff you write about in your book, you know, really taking the action of going into recovery from a food addiction does things to every part of your life.
What I do is I switch it out. As you know, when I wrote The Hunger Fix, I said, you know, that whole issue of deprivation always rears its head. And people say, that's ridiculous. Why can't I have a fill in the blank, whatever it may be? And, you know, truth be told, that you can just switch it. So I call, you know, the stuff that causes you to binge, loss of control, shame, blame, and guilt. I call those false fixes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you feel like you just need something to fix the situation, right? It's a false fix. I want you instead to have a healthy fix. And so I usually challenge people to come up with no less than three different healthier, delicious, amazing alternatives to whatever got you in trouble in the first place. And those alternatives have to be some kind of, food, beverage, whatever, that does not lead you to a sense of loss of control, that does not give you shame, blame, and guilt. So now you have an adventure, an exploration in learning what may or may not work for you, which is kind of fun. And I know you do that over at Beacon too, right?
Oh, yeah. And I think the other thing is, like, you know, I treat people all the time where food is the joy of their life. And, you know, what we really help people find is, like, other joys in their life. And when you can get the addiction under control and you can get the cravings and the dopamine under control, there's a lot of other things to enjoy other than food. And not to say that there isn't incredibly enjoyable food that does not trigger your addiction. But I also think there's more to life than just eating, don't you think? I mean, I know you like love to work out and you're an athlete and all these things. It's like you can't do that while you're so obsessed with food.
Well, the other thing, too, is let's go back to what got people into this in the first place. I mean, there are a lot of things, a lot of elements that one has to consider. You know, if there's an addictive family history, mm-hmm. Then the chance that you'll also be experiencing a higher risk of addictive behavior is there, no question. It's sort of a genetic crapshoot in families. You never know who's going to get it and who's not, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the first thing. The second thing is the environment. What if everyone around you is eating trash, you know, and not exercising and all stressed out? Well, what do you think is going to happen to you as a child? So there's a huge environmental, you know, a piece of this as well. And then speaking of environment, let's just say you're in the best home environment in the world, but then you go to school and you go out into malls and, you know, it's like a flipping battlefield out there. And you have to be able to navigate all of that without succumbing to whatever, you know, a more addictive behavior. And then if you're stressed, If you've got a mood disorder, if you're feeling bad, if you've got depression going on, if you have poor sense of self-confidence and self-worth and maybe body image along with that, you know, you've got yourself a problem. And then, as you know, then there's that beautiful scientific work done by Susan Mason at Harvard with the nurses study showing that if you have a history of PTSD, and this is for women, this is all gender specific, a history of PTSD, all right, that may or may not be associated with the second element, abuse and trauma. Okay. And if this took place during your childhood and early adolescence, your chance of having an addictive eating problem, food addiction, increases by 90% because that's how you self-soothe. Mm-hmm. All right, so now, Molly, you know, with your expertise and with the people you see, you know the mass majority of them have histories like this.
Absolutely.
And that they've
Absolutely.
Been dragging this around forever. So how do you approach this? What's your template, your blueprint for being able to help someone?
I think that this recovery piece, like this recovery from a food addiction, is like learning a new language. It's a little bit sometimes like learning how to write with your left hand instead of with your right hand. And in that way, it's a full-time job. And I love this idea of there being, for many people struggling with trauma, struggling with so many things underneath. And that's why we really focus on getting these behaviors hardwired first. Because if we're really digging into trauma first, then the only thing that our clients know how to do is to go and eat. And then we get into a perpetual cycle. We get to, you know, like, I'm triggered by the trauma, now I'm eating because I talked about the trauma. So in the beginning, we really focus on getting people the skills that they need in order to really, really get long-term success. Because, you know, esteemable acts get you self-esteem. And we know that to be true. And we know that you can act yourself into better thinking. And oftentimes, you know, a year into this, people do some deeper trauma work, but they're shored up enough to know that they have these skills that you talk about in your book, that we talk about here, that are very, very clearly evidence-based. When people only have food to go to, people are only going to go to food. And so we have this high precedent on, you know, we run a lot of the science, I mean, you know this, like a lot of the science is very boring. A lot of what the treatment of this is very boring, like writing down your food, regulating your food, taking the sugar and the, you know, these high glycemic index foods out. Like, that's boring. Like, I don't even think we should waste people's time talking about that. But the exciting things that we have to really, really teach people is what to do when you don't want to do what you know what you should do, right? Because that's, like, everybody can measure 6 ounces of turkey. You know what I mean? Like, obviously. But what happens when we don't want to do that? And I think the thing that really happens to people because of the diet industry in many ways is that a light switch goes off. So if I can't measure 6 ounces of turkey, then I'm just going to go and eat a cupcake. It's the most amazing thinking that happens. People's brains completely turn off because there is no chance in any other area of somebody's life that is successful that this kind of thinking would work, right? So that would be like saying if I had a really hard day at my beautiful job, that I would say, oh, you know what, I'm shutting the whole clinic down, right? Or if I got into a fight with a loved one, I would say, oh, this relationship is over. That is never how I behave in anything that works in my life, right? I do a corrective action plan. I get back on board. And I think that this is a big piece of what goes wrong with people's recovery from their food addiction and their long-term success with any of these programs, is that there is never this harm reduction movement. There's never this movement to say, okay, well, I don't feel like I can eat 6 ounces of turkey. Let me try to use some of these skills. Like, let me try to read a book or make a phone call or put some ice on my neck. You know, there's a lot of research about what Marsha Linehan calls tip skills, which is changing your temperature and doing some paced breathing that can really bring your parasympathetic nervous system up and help for you to get refocused. I mean, this whole thing is about being in our best selves and being focused, but we can't be perfect all of the time. And people are so intent in this dieting to be perfect when that's a real impossibility. The trickier piece of that, by the way, is that we need to strive for perfection. So there's this really big problem that we have, right? We want to strive for perfection, and we're going to mess up, and sometimes we're going to be incredibly willful and not want to do it. But what I talk about with people at Beacon is that we have to be on a dimmer switch. Like, we can't be on this on and off and on and off and on and off. First of all, as a doctor, you know this. I mean, what that does to insulin resistance and what that does to the heart, I mean, it doesn't help that people's reactions to making mistakes on their plan of eating is to go so far off the radar. I mean, what that does to their physical health and emotional health and spiritual health, it ends up making a bad situation much, much worse. And so a lot of the work that we do here is helping people to make healthier mistakes, like helping people to not go and slice all four tires when one tire goes flat. Even if they just slice two tires, sometimes that's better. I mean, the way that people behave, it's as though they, like, leave their car in the middle of the street. And they say, oh, this is over. I'm just going to leave my car. I'm going to go get a new car. And that really does increase this blame and shame that you're talking about. I mean, the way that people are behaving with their food addictions and with trying to be successful at finding recovery, it's not sustainable. It's not sustainable to say, oh, I made one mistake, and now I'm going to go off the reservation for the rest until the next time I feel so demoralized and so horrible. And so we talk to people about frequency, intensity, and duration of lapses, and really working to make those less, to make them sort of less bad, less long, and less intense. But also, he says one more thing because it's so important. Because as much as the lapses happen, and it's so important that the lapses happen, the other thing I think that happens with historic diet failure is that people don't go for the gold. You know what I mean? Like, they don't wake up in the morning saying, like, I am going to do great today. Like, I am going to pitch a no-hitter. This is the day. This is really going to work for me. I think that people have been so historically demoralized that they wake up in the morning and they say, I don't know, maybe I'll be okay today. And that's just, you know, if I was an Olympic athlete and I said, I don't know, Pam, I guess I'll get fifth place at the Olympics. I mean, you know, I wouldn't even come close to placing, right? Because if I say I'm going to go for the gold, I may get silver, I may get bronze. But the vantage point of where people start every day is so important. And I think with the black and white thinking and with the chronic diet failure and with going off the reservation and not really focusing on, you know, like in any good relationship, you get in a fight, you make up, you go back to the relationship, you try to do better. I mean, it's a chronic illness. Like, the addiction is a chronic illness. It needs to be tended to every single day, just like any other illness. So you're not going to do it perfectly.
Well, I love that you said that, though, because this chronicity is something that people need to really wrap their arms around. You know, this is not a situation like the stereotypic myth out there that I've arrived, that
right.
I am, you know, 100%, I am recovered, I am done, I have dropped that weight, I have done whatever I need. No, what you've done is achieved a wonderful milestone. That's great, along with a boatload of smaller milestones along the way to make up for the big one, right? But then you've got to keep showing up and do it. That's why when I wrote The Hunger Fix, I called it Master Recovery.
Because
what it means is, yeah, you're going to be doing this for the rest of your life, for the rest of your life. That actually is the definition of mastery. Because when you look at it, it's the ability to be able to continue to practice, fall down, pick yourself up, practice, and just keep it rocking.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
That's true of everything you do in life. Why should this be different? When it comes to the problem is that when you're eating, right? You have to be, you face that dragon multiple times a day, that whole issue of what's the choice, what do I do? And that's why making the choices as simple as possible, being prepared, having a strategy arms you. And when you're armed like
that, you're going to need to correct. I mean, there's this piece of
yes.
it that I think people think like, we make mistakes. Like, I make mistakes in every area of my life, and I, of course, correct, right? There's something that happens when we make an error with the food that we throw the whole thing out, and there's just no,
yeah, I know.
That's not sustainable. That's not a sustainable solution especially to a chronic illness, right?
Instead of just sort of standing up and saying, what did I learn from that experience?
Oh, I love that.
What can I do better in the future? How do I grow from this, right? And I just think that that's so important. People like you, Molly, are experts in the field, you know, who help guide people through that executive functioning. You know, as you know, executive thinking and functioning is housed in the frontal cortex of the brain, which is right behind our forehead. And it gets hammered when we're in full-on addictive mode. So it's not just that the reward center gets hijacked. You know, the frontal lobe becomes impaired in its function, in its ability to rein in impulsivity, in its ability to plan, organize, strategize, stay mindful,
mm-hmm.
Stay present with your mm-hmm. with your thinking. And so a lot of people just need to be able to be very patient with the learning and the relearning process, and then how to make it sustainable for long-term recovery.
Yeah.
That's what's really key here.
And any successful relationship that people have these goals attached to it. Any successful marriage or family relationship or job or hobby. I mean, I was reading a study about analog pilots that before that, when people were just flying before planes flew themselves, you know that pilots were course correcting 100% of the time? I mean, and I think that that's an acceptance piece that, you know, you're dealing with your food no matter what, right? You're dealing with trying to be moderate, or you're dealing with your binging, or you're dealing with your recovery. I mean, I think you're dealing with the food no matter what. And coming to terms with dealing with it the way that you deal with the successful relationships in your life is such a better way to live. It doesn't have to plague you forever. I think that's what people forget when they're so obsessed with, God, I'm never going to be able to eat a cupcake again. It's like, sometimes for people, I say to them, like, if that cupcake was a person, there would be a restraining order out on cupcakes with you. You know, the kind of abuse and neglect that you give to yourself because you're eating cupcakes. It's just amazing how liberated people become and how their lives change so profoundly. I mean, it's daunting, and I'm sure you've seen this too in your practice. It's daunting when someone who's really addicted to food stops eating the foods that are enhancing the addiction. I mean, they become unrecognizable in many ways, or maybe even just better, extremely better versions of themselves. And it's powerful just through stopping eating the foods that are triggering them. It's amazing.
And what else helps with the recovery process? You know, my mind, mouth, and muscle template is that, you know, obviously going inward, you know, getting those new tools and techniques, meditating, you know, introspection, taking the time to do all of that. At the same time, you know, we have the nutritional end of it, switching it out for the healthy fixes. And then the physical end of it, which is, again, going to mind-body places. So any kind of physical activity really helps enhance the recovery process, whether it's yoga, Pilates, taking that brisk walk, doing it with a friend, doing it alone, with your dog, it doesn't matter. Just getting out of yourself, putting it together, and then finally, being of service to others. Really important to give of yourself, because when you're giving of yourself, and you're immersing yourself in helping someone else, the last thing you do is obsess about your own issues.
I think that's
one of the most kernel pieces of all of this.
Learning to be able to find
places where you can do that. Don't you love that? I mean, it's just part of the recovery process.
Yeah, and I think, like, you know, we're all in this together. And I think that when you can get some really good help and then pay it forward and being somebody, having a support system and being part of someone's support system, that's full circle. I mean, that is a really beautiful recovery in that way.
I love it. And, I really, once again, think that everyone out there really needs to understand there's solid science on this whole issue of food addiction and addictive eating. And one of the places I would highly recommend everyone go to is the National Institute of Drug Abuse, and specifically to their director, Dr. Nora Volkow, V as in Victor, O-L-K-O-W, who has spearheaded so much of this with some of the most extraordinary brain scanning of the Reward Center, and also she's helped fund so much of the research in this field. You could see the hardcore credentialed work that she's done as she's laid down the foundation for us understanding the whole addictive eating process. No question about it. Everyone out there, we've been talking to Molly Carmel. She's a founder of the Beacon Program in New York City, is a leading expert in the whole sector of food addiction. And we've been talking about, food addiction. What can I say? Molly, I cannot thank you enough for being on the Herb podcast. Your wisdom, advice, guidance, and expertise have been invaluable to our Herb podcast listeners as they try to understand how to be able to deal with their own challenges with addictive eating. Thanks so much, Molly.
Thank you, Pam. And, you know, just to remind people, like, this is a solvable problem. And I think it doesn't feel that way a lot of the time, you know?
Oh, yeah. It's definitely a solvable problem. Go to Molly's website, which is the Beacon Program, that's spelled B-E-A-C-O-N program.com, to learn more about her amazing work. She also has a Facebook, the Beacon Program, and on Twitter, the same thing. And it's really important for you to know you've got help out there. And I've written The Hunger Fix, which is the consumer book in this field. And I'm just saying there's a lot of good solutions that you can use. So it's time now to make that change. And as Molly loves to say, get free from all of this. You can start on that lifelong recovery. Thanks, Molly. All right, everyone. Remember to catch every episode of Her, including this one. Just hit subscribe on iTunes or on our show page at RadioMD.com. And please take 30 seconds and just rate this podcast on iTunes, because we want to attract more people just like you to the show. And that happens when you take the time to rate it. While you're there, can you leave a review as well? Just remember, I read these things and I love to be able to hear from you. I'm Dr. Pam Peek. Hey, follow me on Twitter at PamPeekMD, and you can also check out our Her Show page at RadioMD.com for all of our past episodes. Thanks for listening, and stay well.